Welcome to Talking Cybersecurity, a weekly podcast listened to by people in over 40 countries around the world. My name is Richard Herron. This podcast involves people talking cybersecurity. Expect to hear about data breaches, different approaches to cybersecurity, and reports on cybersecurity events that I or my guests attend. Opinions expressed by myself or my guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of my organisation or the organisation my guests are associated with. If you want to continue the conversation, feel free to join the LinkedIn group Talking Cybersecurity. Thanks to Pixabay for allowing me to use their music. Hi everyone, welcome back to Talking Cybersecurity. I was going to have a break over Christmas New Year, but what else am I going to do over the holiday period? So it's full steam ahead with podcasting for me. Over the next few weeks, you'll hear an interview I did with John from Perth, who is a security engineer. Thus the title of the episode, Life of a Security Engineer. Christmas is over for another year. I hope it went well for you and your family. The Kris Kringle present exchange is now very popular. I hope you received something nice. The Christmas break has given me time to play around with the podcast. Apart from the new name, Talking Cybersecurity, we have added some music, and thanks to all the positive feedback concerning the music, expect more music in the future. We received lots of positive feedback concerning episodes 50 to 52, where we were talking cybersecurity with Lue Gashash from Spartan Security. If you liked what Lue had to say, why not give his services a try? On to episode 53. Last month, I interviewed John, a very security-focused individual, and you'll pick that up during the next three episodes. John fits into a few categories: security engineer, security analyst, security software specialist, pen tester, and last but by no means least, an absolutely lovely guy. The conditions of the interview weren't great. Open space, windy, and substandard mobile recording equipment. I have spent numerous amounts of hours trying to fix the recording quality, and you'll certainly notice moments when the sound quality and volume fluctuates. To steal a line from the 60s show Get Smart, sorry about that, Chief, but at least you'll have some security content to listen to over the next 3 weeks. To compensate, I will publish a transcript, summary, and key takeaways on the Talking Cybersecurity LinkedIn group at the end of these three episodes, and I'll try and backtrack and do that for the Lue Gashash three episodes as well. So apologies again for the sound quality, and a big apology to you, John from Perth. I'm just sorry the sound isn't as perfect as I would have liked. Having said all that, you will still be able to hear John and I cover many topics. Here is the first of three episodes with John.
Hi everyone, it's Richard again. We're talking cybersecurity, and this week I found myself in Perth. Now I'm talking to someone I think he described himself as a security engineer, and we'll refer to him as John. Hey John, how are you doing?
Hey Richard, I'm doing great.
That's good to hear. Now, I'd say we'd describe you as a security engineer. Would that be right to call you a security engineer?
Yes, that's correct. So at my current role, I am in the process of designing, implementing, and looking after the security of the company on the technical level.
Yep.
So I would look after the SIEM solution, various other security solutions, such as Carbon Black, our EDRs. From the various layers down, I would look after the security of our company and ISIL, make justifications and test security products to see how good they are and how they compare to other areas in the market. As well as I also do a bit of pen testing and what we would call EDR evasion, bypassing. So testing of security systems in a way to see if that product or that EDR or NDR system is able to be bypass fairly easily, and if so, we will then decide whether we choose to go with that product or another product.
Now, the listeners obviously can't see you, but I can. I've known you for a few years now. You're only 29. I know you've got a very good understanding of EDRs, MDRs, NDRs, as well as sort of a SecOpsy type role. How did you get so much wide and deep knowledge of all these tools and SecDevOps and all that? You're only 30.
Yeah. So it started when I was in year nine. Actually, one of my computer science teachers then, he showed us a documentary on hacking. And what interested me was SCADA hacking at the time that they showed in the documentary.
Did you know anything about IT or security at that stage?
No.
Wow,
Once I was, in year nine, that's when I really got into it. And by 2010, which is about a year later, that's when I was very deep into learning how to program. So I was basically teaching my computer science teacher at that point how to code in Python.
Within a year?
Yes.
Wow.
That's why I enjoy CTFs, which we may go into later. It's the challenge and the problem solving. I'm very focused on one thing, and if I can't solve it, I'll try my best to solve it.
Okay. 2009, 2010, you're in year 9, year 10.
Yeah.
At this stage, you know nothing about IT, but you picked it up really quickly. Within a year, you've learned. What language was it you learned very well?
So I initially learned Python. Python was actually part of the syllabus in year 10 and year 11. Yeah. I'd learned it prior in year 9 after learning the hacking course.
Yeah.
After that, I decided programming, I really enjoy, I like how programs function. Then I discovered a whole new area of programming, which was low-level programming, such as assembly, x86, MIPS, all the various flavors of assembly, and C and C++. And I got very interested in that because it deals more with memory management, efficient in Python, C, C++, and assembly x86, and Haskell.
Haskell. In my day, it was Haskell, folks. Now it's Haskell.
Yeah.
Was it trial and error? How did you...
Initially, it started with there was a PS3 dev scene, which is essentially, I wanted to learn how to hack games on the PlayStation 3 and how to mod them. A lot of hackers tend to come, especially dealing with low-level vulnerability research, they tend to come from the game hacking scene.
Yep.
Because it teaches you the fundamentals of how to read assembly, how to write assembly, how to use assembly as a programming language, and that's what vulnerability research is all about, essentially looking at for vulnerabilities in programs are compiled, and then you have to decompile them, and you have to understand the program flow. And that just got me really interested because if I was able to QA flag, which is a technique used back then that I managed to figure out because it wasn't public at the time, which allowed you to upgrade the firmware of the device so then it can be rooted or hacked. Like, much like an iPhone. So you could load Linux on it.
During year 9, 10, 11, you're learning coding, you do year 12. What happens after year 12 for you?
So after year 12, I go straight to ECU. I study cybersecurity.
Was that the primary course you studied?
Yes.
Okay.
And it was the first year that they'd introduced the course. So it was the only course in WA that actually did cybersecurity, regarded as one of the best.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, I just fell in love with that. I went to they used to be Ruxmon and RuxCon back in the day. I'd attend those conferences, meet up with people, network, and I just found fascinating. But I found studying at uni, I found it very, like, it's theory. It's not so much that practical getting to know how to, like, actually the technical aspect of coding and how to figure out a problem. It's more the theory behind it, which a lot of people know, but they can't apply it. Found CTFs kind of helped me in that regard.
Here's a question for you. So it was a three-year course at ECU?
Yes, 3 years.
Did you meet people there with common interests that you've kept in touch with ever since uni, or not really? Or
There's two that have, and they were serious about it. A lot of the other people were kind of not so serious. But I would say there was a lot more serious people back then than there are now.
What do you mean by more serious? Just more intense?
More. They're doing it because they love it.
Okay.
Whereas back then, yeah, they did it because they loved it. Whereas now it's more kind of for the money.
Yeah.
There's the talent pool is maybe, I mean, it's good that there's more people learning cybersecurity. Yes. It's great. I wouldn't recommend it more than, like, I want more people to do cybersecurity. Yes.
When you went to uni, you did a 3-year course at ECU. At the end of that 3-year course, what year would have that been? 2016. Right, so about 7-ish years ago. You finished your course and went, great, I've got my degree in cybersecurity. What did you think your first job would be?
Actually, my first job would have been penetration testing. That's what I was always aiming for.
But is that what, that was your aim, but did you get to be a penetration tester?
Well, I did pen testing as a job after the, well, in uni.
So contract?
Yeah, contract. So it's more experience, you gain experience.
But were they willing to give you, even though you were still at uni, were they willing to pay you to be a bit of a pen tester?
Yes, yes.
How did you convince them? Because it wasn't me, obviously, that I was still at uni.
Just my passion for it at the time. Okay. So I'm very passionate. Like, I can talk for days about security and especially the offensive side. Defensive, I would say, is much harder than offensive. A hacker only has to be lucky once, whereas a defender has to be lucky all the time.
And may I agree with that comment that you could talk about security for days, because I think we've been talking about 5 hours straight today. Anyway, your first job, that was it, you got your degree, you said, I want to become a pen tester. So where did you find that first real job? And you don't have to mention company names, but what was the title of the first job and how long were you there for and what did you do there?
The title of my first job was pen testing. That was for a company that was for small to medium businesses, so Send Security, who I did for about a year and a half. And then I went to Quantium to do IT security engineering.
And what does Quantium do?
Quantium does software development, but they focus on more data science and big data. So they have contracts with Woolworths. So the pay card, they actually deal with that. And I was in a infrastructure team. I would help with a lot of malware analysis, a lot of reverse engineering of various phishing emails, and it's all malware that would come in, and we had utilized QRadar, which was one of our scene solutions at the time.
I have used it, and it's a good tool, yep.
Yeah, oh, it's an amazing tool. Yeah. It's like, as my colleague said, it's basically Wireshark on steroids times 100.
All right, so there you are, you're coming in. Now, were you learning little things on the job?
So the more I was in pen testing and I realized there's a red teaming component to it. And within red teaming, obviously, it's an engagement and it goes for long periods.
Explain also like red, what a red team and a blue team is all about. We might go into the other colours. We'll skip the red and blue team.
What's purple. Yeah, so essentially a red team is a group of pen testers that have a lot of experience. And it's usually a group of people, it's more than one person usually. And it's an engagement that goes for 3 to 6 months. I've seen some go for a year. It just depends on the scope. But essentially what it is depending on the scope, is if it's covert, then no one knows about it in the company, even the security people. Maybe the CISOs or the higher-ups know, but generally no one knows. And then they try and break them by any means necessary.
Including physical?
Yes, physicals, physical, phishing, anything goes. And see how far they can get. And if they're able to get to, say, domain admin, then security's not the best.
I know you paused there because I put my hand up, and my hand up was, you said typically you wouldn't tell anyone. So if you were playing a red team, so an external team to try and break in, whether it's physically or social engineering or technically, you said, I think you said typically you wouldn't warn anyone in the company. What are the benefits of not warning the company about the red team event? That's okay.
Yep. The benefits of that is basically for the SOC or the blue team, which is essentially your IT security analysts and engineers within the company that look after the security and monitor the security within the company. Essentially, that's beneficial because they have to always be on their toes because an attacker, it can happen day or night, anytime. Yeah. It's not a, oh, I'm going to stop attacking now and have a ceasefire.
You're right, because if you're going to do a surprise attack, why would you tell the SOC stuff, oh, Ben, I'll look out, we're going to attack you. The hackers don't give us any warning, so a red team, you're right, shouldn't give us any warning either.
As I was saying, it depends on the scope. There is over red teaming, which is you tell the blue team and you tell mainly you just tell the blue team about it that it's going on. But in my opinion, I wouldn't say it's as effective because it's only effective if you want to show the security controls. So there could be a red team where the scope is, say, stay undetected for this long and try and get as far as you can and move laterally throughout the network.
They go long and slow. What's your opinion? Do you think a red team could be successful in almost any company trying to break in, getting, or would you say some companies, you could break in easy and you could get all these credentials, and some you'd probably break in for a phishing email, but you might get far from
there? So definitely. So it's all about generally attackers, especially ransomware crews, they tend to go for low-hanging fruit. So any internet-facing devices, they'd use programs like Shodan or Census and scour the internet with their API and see this is vulnerable to this internet public-facing is vulnerable to, say, some public CVE that's out there, and they can break in easily that way. So it's all down to your security posture, how you protect your perimeter, how you protect your actual patching process. Yeah, it's a defense in depth layer. It's not just one single thing. So I've seen companies get what we call as homed within an hour to domain admin. So from a standard user to domain admin in an hour.
I'm going to put you really on the spot here. So for people listening who just say they're about to have a red team, blue team next month or next 3 to 6 months, is if 3 to 5 things reduce the likelihood that they're going to gain credentials? Because you mentioned one already, patching. How important is patching, keeping that up to date? And have you got any theories about 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, 1 week patching?
Patching, I would say, is are very important, especially critical highs. I would definitely prioritize those.
How soon would you be patching them?
Depending on the vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if it's a 10 CVSS score and it's internet facing, I would patch that immediately, straight away.
That makes sense,
But if it's, say, a local privilege escalation bug where you actually need to be in the network and you actually have to have that user's credentials or some credential where you can escalate privileges to a higher user, I'd say that maybe 2 weeks. And it sort of depends if it's a server or if it's corporate hosted, corporate environment.
We hear a lot about low-rated patching. What's your theory there? Would it be do mediums within 2 months and lows within 3 months? Or is it really... Is it patch everything or is it prioritized?
I would prioritize. It's a lot harder to do because you have to prioritize based on the score. Whereas if you patch everything at once, then it's a lot easier for the system administrator to do that. Personally, I would have where you do patching criticals and then highs and then lows or mediums and lows. And I would critical straight away or within at least 24, 48 hours, because there's been cases where an hour after an exploit's been released, ransomware crews have actually used that to gain entry into an environment. My stance from a straight security perspective is patch immediately.
Okay. You know, patching is one of those things we will refer to as basic hygiene factors or basic hygiene. Why do you think so many companies lax on patching? Oh, we'll just do it every 90 days. Is it a resource thing? They don't want to pay people to come in on the weekend. They've got to pay people to test their applications, make sure the patch isn't effective. What do you
think? Yeah, I would say it's more than to do with patching. It's a lot of it's to do with how people think patching should be done, which is 90 days of track culture. But I would also say that, yeah, there's a lot of applications of patching. It's not just OS level patching like Patch Tuesdays of Windows. It's application patching. Some companies don't have a policy where it's only certain applications can run, like using AppLock or a WDAC. With patching, it's a very hard topic to completely get everything patched. Definitely prioritize patching with the highs and critical.
Who do you think's calling the shots when it comes to patching? Like, you and I want patching every week. In most organizations, is it IT managers, IT infrastructure managers, is it CIOs? Who is calling the shots and who should be calling the shots?
It depends on the company.
Yeah, of course.
But managers tend to decide the patch cycle has been
based on convenience.
Yes, and from a security perspective, I would prefer people use patching if it was done by security professionals, because the reason sysadmins do patching is because there can be compatibility issues, so they want to wait a while. But from a security perspective, the longer you wait, the higher chance of you getting breached.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of organisations, and probably every organisation, let's just say they're on a monthly patching cycle. So they'll apply the patch on Friday night to the development environment. The application owners will come in on Saturday or Sunday, they'll test their applications, and I go, thumbs up, didn't affect their application, so you already had a patch next week. So that's sort of been a historical model, because the application owners, they have to make sure that the patch doesn't affect their application.
Yep.
However, I have heard that a lot of companies these days, they just patch and then suffer, because patching, you want to close that exposure time period for vulnerability. They just patch these days, and then if it breaks, geez, we have to fix it.
But
nine times out of ten, I'm trying to think of, I think it's about 2014, 2015, maybe there was a major patch that really stuffed up a lot of applications.
It's a lot rarer these days because it's QA involved at Microsoft or these various.
And Microsoft would really pick up the game. Would you almost be advocating that this patch?
At a minimum, personally, I would say patch straight away. And if you're a bit hesitant, maybe 3 days would be the max, I would say.
We talked a lot about patching then, because I think patching is important. The reason we started talking about patching is when I said, you know, what are those 3 to 5 controls you could really have in place that would make it harder for the red team to break in? So patching is one. I'm going to lead the witness here. MFA, you'd be a big advocate.
MFA is a big one.
And on that MFA note, we will pause for another week. I've got a few plans for the Talking Cybersecurity podcast. Hopefully I'll be able to put them in place within a fortnight. Time to go, my friends. It is New Year's Eve. And on that New Year's Eve note, if you are going out tonight, enjoy yourself, but please stay safe. I'll be asleep by 10 p.m, so no one text me at midnight. As my dad used to say on every New Year's Eve, have the rest of the year off. Hopefully you'll all have a good 2024, and I'll speak to you next year. Thanks so much for listening to the Talking Cybersecurity podcast in 2023, and I'll try my best to improve the podcast in 2024. Before I forget it, our presenter John wanted me to say a big hi to his buddy Jason. So there's a big magic hello to you, Jason, out there listening to the podcast, hopefully. If you go out tonight, please look after yourself as well. But that obviously applies to everyone. So again, everyone, it was a fantastic 2023. Thanks for listening. More in store for 2024. And as my dad used to say, have the rest of the year off. See you guys. Bye.